And that's how that happened. And we attacked it with a vengeance. And I think, again, the thing that was so interesting about that band was we so loved the music and we so over-rehearsed everything we did that we just outworked everybody. You could hear how hard we worked at our music and how much we loved our music. We weren't there for the girls. We weren't there for the accolades. We were there to turn people on to how much we loved music, and that was really apparent in what we did. So we kind of became this perfect kind of band for David Anthony to say, would you mind just touring the whole five-state area and being one of our headliners? Because we could send out the Ravens or Crow or some of these bigger groups, but they really want to play in town. They don't want to play a bunch on the road. But you can keep this ballroom circuit alive because you're just as good, but you're willing to travel. So we said, no problem. Well, we ended up being like a satellite, the moon. We were circling the earth, never got an opportunity to land very often. So when we did, it was generally at Aldrich Arena, or it would be the state fair the following summer for in the teen land. We would end up and we would blow people away. They'd love us, but then where do they go? The Hitus are off and running to Fargo. We're off and running to Wisconsin. And so that kind of became the drawing card. We didn't have a problem with it because we ended up actually having a huge draw in Wisconsin and northern Minnesota and the ballrooms. And we had a far reach with our band.
How did you get around? Did you have a band vehicle? Or?
Yes, we did. Well, of course, we had the hearse. Everybody has to go through the period of where you've got the hearse. And we were coming back through Little Falls one night, and I remember Jim Larkin was driving. And a rabbit runs out in front of us, and he runs over. He says, uh-oh. I go, what happened? He says, bad, bad, bad omen. I said, what's that? I ran over a rabbit. And the last time I ran over a rabbit, we blew the engine. Yeah, that ain't going to happen. And all of a sudden, kapow, we blew the engine. So we got towed back, and we had some friends in the neighborhood hoist out an engine, put another one in. But it lasted for about another 6 months, and it was like, we gotta move on. So then my dad built a trailer. We got this big old Chrysler could just a freight train of a car that had the big globe windshield with the big globe dashboard that lit up and a heat that would blow you out. And so we had great big Chrysler pulling a trailer down the road. And then, of course, we did that for a couple of years. And eventually, in about 68, we got ourselves, 67, we got ourselves a nice Dodge van and equipped it out. And we're now into vans.
Let's run through some of the places the Hitus played.
You bet. Well, we were again big in the ballroom circuit. We had George's Ballroom in New Ulm was fabulous. The Kimball Ballroom up in Kimball, Minnesota. The Parkway Ballroom in Foley, and that was interesting. A lot of bikers. That was a kind of a biker's roadhouse kind of a vibe. The Tower Teen Center was in Austin, Minnesota. They had the Fun House up in Little Falls. And Nisswa Fun, they had a place called The Blazer. And you would show up there in January to play, and there was no heat in the joint. So when you pull up, it was like this summer dance hall that they would roll in these big heaters. And we'd start loading in, and they roll these heaters in, and they would just pump heat into this place to heat it up while we're setting up. Keep them going until they open up the doors and they shut it off, and the body heat would keep it heated for the rest of the night.
That's in northern Minnesota, correct?
Yes, it was up in Brainerd. It was called the Blazer. And then we played a lot in Wisconsin, and the Airway Bar in Marshfield was one that was a lot of fun. We would get 40 or 50 of our friends would caravan down. We'd rent a whole wing of the hotel and play there. For Mortel, we play there for like 4 or 5 nights in a row. A lot, we'd go back there twice a summer. And Eau Claire was real big for the London Inn. And when we became so popular in Wisconsin, when we played the London Inn, Eau Claire, the university would have us in. They'd interview us, and they would. We were all the people in the music. Programs would come out and watch us because we were, again, there was something about the dedication to how musically we approached things that if you paid attention to that and if that meant anything, we really got under your blood. We were never these lady killers these really hip, tall guys that could play, you know, powerful metal music. We're just musical. And in Wisconsin is kind of white bread and male, like the east side of St. Paul. They very much embraced us. So and the Bloomer Ballroom and the Rice Lake Pavilion, Richardson's Pavilion in Clayton, a whole circuit there that we probably played as much as we did anywhere, and particularly in the summer, that was a fun circuit to play.
You mentioned Jim Larkin. How did he come to join the band, and what time period was that?
Well, Jim Larkin, about 1966, Tom Mulkern had now turned into just a great singer and a reluctant singer. He was the best singer in the band, and I always made him sing. He wanted me to sing, but I said, "You're singing. You're the guy with the soul." And he got working on, in fact, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. And he said, "I was just sitting down to learn that tune." He says, "My mom says, Tom, you got a letter from Uncle Sam in the mail." And he had been drafted, Vietnam War. And so I said, "Every time I hear that song, I think about that moment." Anyway, that was sad when he had to leave, because he was my best friend, my mentor. He was really the heart and soul of what we did. We now really needed to find a replacement that could not so much be this fantastic guitar player, but a fantastic singer. And I happened to be watching the B-Sharp music show on TV, and I saw the Ravens on there, and I saw Jim Larkin singing. He had replaced Lonnie Knight for a short period of time, like a 6 or 7 month stint, and he was singing these Beatle tunes. He had a great voice. And David Anthony told me, "Oh yeah, Jim." I told him, Tommy got drafted. He said, "Well, Jim Larkin's going to be available, because he was just filling in as a fill-in for the Ravens." So I called him up and made him an offer. He came over and loved the band. He was a rhythm guitar player, played a lot like Enrico Rosenbaum, or had that kind of vibe, just a handsome kid that really sang well, played decent rhythm guitar. And the Heatus now had that sexy singer, so that all of a sudden made us more popular as we moved closer to the Twin Cities.
And did you have other personnel changes?
Yes, but then along the line, we ran into Dick Schreier. He had been with the Marauders, and he was a guy that really could sing Smokey Robinson and R&B. Again, David Anthony said, "Would you ever consider going five pieces? There's this R&B singing guitar player that's fantastic, and I think with him and Jim Larkin, you could have an unbelievable vocal thing going on." So we brought him in, and I'll be doggone, I'll tell you, when you put those two guys together, we now had some real punch in the vocals. So now we've really become, we're playing the New City Opera House, Magoo's, and we're becoming very, very hot commodity in the Twin Cities, because we've got that star power fronting this musical band.
And your music has now evolved to include more of a variety of types.
You bet. We always kind of attacked music with intelligent arrangements and just great tunes that nobody else does. That was kind of like what we wanted. But we were always more on the group ensemble. Now we could go out and do Temptations type stuff, but we had the guy that could sing the lead. We could do the Hollies. We could do the Beach Boys. We could do all of these, any bag you wanted to do. We had the singer that could match up, and we had the vocal chops and the musicality to pull it off. So now we were really beginning to be a force to reckon with. And I mean, people were just showing up to see us. And the one thing about the Heatus were, we had probably musicians were our biggest fans, more so. You got some bands where they just attract all the people. Wherever the people go, that's where that. We weren't one of those kind of bands. To this point, we hadn't been, but we were the ones where the people that were really into the music, the musicians in particular, loved this band because they could see the heart. They wouldn't work as hard as we'd work on this stuff, so they can come out and appreciate it because we logged the hours to do it, because that's what our DNA was. But now when you put Dick Schreier and Jim Larkin up front singing, we had that wow factor. When you put that all together, that's when you get the makings of something very, very special. It was short-lived, because what ended up happening now was that bands that had bigger pocketbooks and were higher up on the food chain came out and started to pick us. The Marauders, or the Morticians had an opening, offered Drick Schreier the gig, and it paid a lot more money than we were paying, and it was more popular gigs. And then...
So Dick left?
Then Dick left.
And who replaced him?
And Dick was then replaced with Kevin Hines. And Kevin Hines was somebody I went to grade school with that was just a fan of the band, but he would always, a friend of mine, he'd always come over and just sing these beautiful high notes and had great, and Dick had was really a good tenor. And so I said to Kevin, I said, Kevin, did you ever consider being a singer in our band? Because we now we're going after the Hollies, and he could sing Carrie Ann better than Graham Nash could. And had that kind of range. And we said, boy, that's a forest. And he said, yeah, well, I'll do that. So he became kind of our tenor, the guy that we could throw up on top, because we kind of got used to that. And that's what Schreier had been. So then we're playing at New City Opera House, and Still Roving stopped in to see us. And they were just gotten a record deal, but they lost their singer. And so they offered Jim a chance to be their lead singer. And they were going to cut a record, and it was going to be played on the air, and had this whole thing going. So he comes, goes, guys, I can't say no to this. So that kind of pull those two people. It's like losing the grill on the Bentley. It was gone. And we kind of became the roving He-Twos again.
Were you wearing the matching stage outfits and so forth?
You know what? We did that probably in, I would say, 65, 66. But around 67, we started to get into the more the independent, the three-dog night look, if you will. With the longer hair and the mustaches and the baggy shirts and the kind of the pirate look.
What do you recall about the Battle of the Bands at Aldridge Arena?
Fabulous opportunity. That probably was the single most important event for that particular band, because it was a venue where all eyes were on everybody. Everybody who was anybody played that thing, and we got up there, and we happened to have one of the best nights we ever had. And I remember Jigs Lee came up after it was done, and he looked, he said, my God, I thought the Underbeats were good. He said, I thought the Ramones were good. He said, I've never heard vocals like that. And that was saying a lot, because we really just flat out worked it. We didn't have that kind of talent. But we did have that kind of act, and we really did. It upped our stock a lot. Again, there were times where when we were on our game, just because of how hard we worked at what we did, it registered, it connected, and it left an indelible mark. There are people to this day that will say, I remember you guys at Aldrich Arena. You blew my mind. And unfortunately, we didn't record any of that. But it was there, and so like I said, we're probably the most unknown musical force there was, and part of that I think was because we were reluctantly, you know, we just didn't want to market ourselves as anything other than we loved music and we happened to be from St. Paul, and of course you're in St. Paul, you're a treasure to St. Paul, and you're unknown to Minneapolis, so that kind of became the kind of the give and the take of how that all ended up for that effort. A lot of people remember it. It was great times. You had to be there to experience it. But truly, more people didn't know about us than knew about us.
Do you think part of that might have been the band didn't have a 45 out?
Absolutely. And that was my fault, probably more than anything, because I was more of the business guy for this band. And I just, my attitude was, we don't have any business putting 45 off because we don't write songs well. Big mistake on my part, because I gave too much credit to that's something I couldn't possibly do, because I've written songs since, and when I stopped separating, well, that's, I'm not good enough for that, and we're not good enough for that, and it's because I put the measuring stick up so high as to who the great songwriters were, and I'm not one of those, so let's not even think about it.
So you didn't want to record cover songs?
No, I thought that would be stupid. You know, we've recorded cover songs. It yielded nothing. We were, again, I think it was really all about, you know, if we were in the early 60s, would be sitting there going, why write a song when you can't compete with Lennon and McCartney? You know, if you think you can, great. Or or so there was always like the bar was set so high, and I figured, you know what, I just never really had the desire to tour, never had the desire to make a record, just really wanted to play in a room with people hearing the music and playing with great musicians.
So did the Heat 2s do any recordings in a studio?
Yes, we did. We about 67 we did a couple of attempts. One was a gentleman out of Mankato was a record promoter, concert promoter, that had a couple of groups that were local for him. He booked, and he had heard us play and said, I'd love to sign you. We're going to do an independent label, and I love the way your version of Romeo and Juliet by The Reflections. Would you consider recording that down there? I can get it played in the smaller stations around the five-state area. We said, sure. So we went down and recorded that in Chicago. It turned out real nice. We had an acetate of it. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened to the acetate.
Do you know what studio that was done at?
No, I do know it was down in the Rush Street area. We were staying right on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago, and it wasn't any farther than a 10-minute drive to the studio, and I do not know the studio.
So it was only pressed up as an acetate. It was never pressed on vinyl?
Never was, no. No, and he kind of, after that was all done, he kind of disappeared on us, and we just kind of, well, he disappeared. We just kind of kept moving. Then the other thing was David Anthony wanted us to do something. He said we needed to have a record if we wanted to go to the next level. And he liked the version of I'm Alive that we did by the Hollies. But he said, would you be up to making it more your own? I said, sure. He said, no, but I'd like to do something really unique. I'd like to have you guys sing it, but I really like you to use the crow to play it while you're singing it. So let's have this thing be a live recording. And I said, well, that's interesting. So we had a rehearsal, and we just reinvented the whole song. It was the concept. I would never have thought about the groove, but of course, Larry and Dick Wiegand, you got to love their ideas. They were fantastic. And so it turned into something very neat, and we went in and we recorded it all at one time, had the acetate on that, and again, nothing ever happened after that. And I didn't, you know, like I say, if that's where I just didn't have, I wasn't aggressive enough to know that I should do something about that. Somebody says, we're going to record you. I go, great, record us and make us happen. That was it.
And the recording of the Holly song, where was that done?
That was done at Universal, the old audio, Universal Audio, which is Creation now.
The old K-Bank.
The old K-Bank, yep.
So that would have been Larry Wiegand on bass, Dick Wiegand on guitar, and do you recall who played drums?
Boy, I don't.
So the Holly's song is also just pressed as an acetate only?
That was it. And we had that. My sister kind of kept all the band pictures and records and things of this nature. So I called her. I said, you wouldn't happen to have that. She said, Tom, I gave that to you in 1983. Don't you know what you did with it? I go, no, it's in a box somewhere that I don't own, I'm sure. So, unfortunately, that we have very little on tape to prove that we ever even existed.
So, to this day, there is no acetate or tape of either one of those two songs?
Correct.
The band recorded?
Correct.
Okay, so what happens next in the history of the Heat 2s?
Well, we kind of just, like I say, when we lost Dick and Jim to larger forces out there, we kind of went back to playing the... Tom Mulkern returned in about 68, and we were back to kind of the original core guys, just playing the ballroom circuit again and having fun with it, but... We're traveling a lot now they had 8-tracks, then we would play them in the van on the long rides out, the long ride back, and we started listening to Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago coming in. We said, God, listen to these guys. I mean, this is a whole kind of a jazzy, far-out musical thing taking place with music, and it's still pop, and they're playing it on the radio, and wouldn't that be neat to some point in time play some of that? And, of course, we had kind of gone from being an instrumental band to being a vocal band. And so now it was like, what would it be like if we'd be a horn band?
And there were other horn bands around town, right?
There were, but there weren't any that could really sing. It was like they had a singer, and then they had horns, and they did a lot of R&B tunes, but it wasn't like the kind of stuff we were hearing that was breaking out. There was a new thing that was beginning to break out. You had, you know, the earliest, you know, you had Blood, Sweat, and Tears. You had Chicago. Early forms of Earth, Wind, and Fire, which really were when Maurice White was in Ramsey Lewis Trio, was that early kind of jazz is kind of coming into rock. And we go, ooh, jazz into rock. It's kind of groovy. And we still can listen to Chicago. You can still harmonize. So, again, there was a window there to take another ride. And at that point in time, we thought, you know what? We've kind of done this He-Too's thing, and we've traveled the ballroom circuit, had a lot of fun with it. But there's a new monster out there that we want to tackle. There's a new thing that made us all 15 years old again. And that's the idea of bringing in jazz, bringing in horns, and expanding our musical horizons. So that's when we made a decision. I think the He-Too's, it's time to put them to bed.
So you brought in horn players at this time?
Yes, we did. We had two friends of the band that both played trumpet, and Dave Vigran played trumpet and valve bone and mellophonium, which really sounded like a bone, looked like a French horn, had a higher range. And he altered it with a hacksaw and solder, and it looked like a French horn that bent under. Well, he ended up the bell pointing straight out like a trombone, and he could play incredible solos on it, and it was a weapon. So he played that, trumpet, bone, and mellophonium, and then Rich Mueller played trumpet, and we now had the makings of a horn band. And, of course, I played a little bit of tenor from my old playing in the band in high school, so we occasionally would have three horns.
And is this where there's a name change also?
Yes, there is. At this point in time, it was like a vision came that this was it. We've been preparing our entire life to go into a new direction. We felt really, really good about it, and we thought it was time to find something that really expressed who we were. So we put the word out and had to name this band, Where We're Going, a contest amongst everybody in the band and amongst all our fans, and my brother's girlfriend came up with the name Free and Easy.
And the band decided to pick that name.
Yes, we did. That kind of said it all.
So that brings an end to the He-Too's at around what time period now?
This would have been the fall of 68.
Okay. So looking back on the Fortunes and the He-Too's, any particular memories you have that are special to you?
I would say it's always the first time discovery. How do notes work? How do chords work? How does playing with another musician work? How does playing in front of your first audience work? They're life experiences that you take for granted when you're inside the music business. And, you know, most people, it's like, I don't know what it's like to be in the locker room of a football team. I don't know what that culture is. And a lot of people don't know what the culture is to make somebody pick up an instrument and play it and work so hard at it and go through that road. So I would say the discovery of what happens when you follow your heart, whatever that is. And for me, it happened to be music. And I stumbled across how the business of music worked. And it never did take away my love for the music. And so that's why I'm here with you right now. I appreciate what you're doing and what you and Denny are doing here, because you're really bringing to the forefront how it all began and how it really worked. And it was a special time that very few of us were able to experience. So I'd say it's the memories.
Tom, thank you for sharing with us your experience with the Fortunes and the He-Too's. The preceding interview was recorded on May 26, 2012 at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Denny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MinniePaulMusic.com. Just like
just like